there was no clue. There was no tip-offs. There was no anything. The day started as any other day. I woke up, you know, had some coffee. My wife and I were hanging out. I had just started a new job. Our biggest competitor had wooed me away. And normally, prior to taking this new job, I worked out of the house. This job required that I drive from our home in Connecticut into Manhattan. So she walks me to the front door. We kiss each other goodbye. I get in the car. I drive. Any other day, I park my car in the garage. I take the elevator up 37 floors. And I get to my desk. And I start unpacking my things. And I put my cell phone down. And I see that I have a missed call and a voicemail. I said, geez, I was holding my phone the entire time. How did I miss a call? Well, anyway, let me pick it up and listen to it. And it was the following. It said, Mr. Sandlin, this is Special Agent McTiernan with the FBI. We are at your residence and have a warrant for your arrest. You need to call us and come home immediately, or we will issue a warrant with the federal marshals.
That was Craig Stanland. And this is episode 10 of the Bobby Jagdiv podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to what is a milestone episode of the podcast. Yes, this is my 10th episode, and it feels like quite an achievement to have got to this stage in my podcasting journey, and also a real privilege to be able to share, and I guess to mark this milestone episode with quite a unique and special conversation. Now, my guest today defrauded Cisco out of the tune of around $1 million. And upon conviction of that fraud, was incarcerated in a federal prison in Connecticut in the US. Now, how does somebody with a successful career, a beautiful home, and a supporting family end up miscalibrating their moral compass? And what is the aftermath of those decisions? What is the fallout? How does one rebuild, reinvent, and eventually forgive themselves to prepare themselves for a new life outside of prison? Well, these are one of many questions that shape my conversation today with Craig Stanland. Each time Craig hit the enter button to process a fraudulent transaction, he wasn't just funding a lifestyle. He was inadvertently changing the trajectory of his future and also the future of the people around him. Craig wasn't just the architect of the fraud, but he was also the architect of his own reality. A reality that made it acceptable in his mind to qualify that what he was doing was okay, that it wasn't illegal. Even when he was quizzed by his wife, his accountant, he just brushed them away because his reality wouldn't allow him to accept that what he was doing was wrong. Craig was in such denial on the legality of his fraud that he even paid taxes on every fraudulent dollar earned and kept intrinsic records of every transaction. Basically just handed it on a plate to the FBI's forensic accountants. Now, in today's conversation, we not only map out the mechanics of the fraud, but also Craig's journey of self-forgiveness, his reinvention, one where trusting himself and rebuilding his own integrity was firstly dependent on him decoding that distorted reality that he'd created for himself. We also go into detail around the day that Craig was arrested by the FBI. And as part of the conversation, Craig also provides us with this snapshot of life in a federal prison for a white-collar criminal. Since being released from prison, Craig has been rebuilding his life, reinventing himself, and now resides in an amazing apartment overlooking a park in Brooklyn, in New York. And, you know, during this conversation, you can hear the birds tweeting. it's quite symbolic because the survival of most species of birds is predicated on their freedom of movement to migrate to different climates when the seasons demand it. And the intermittent tweeting is a gentle reminder of Craig's new reality. Shortly after being released from prison, Craig also graced the TEDx stage with a talk to share some of his story. And that talk has now hit something like 100,000 views on YouTube. It's pretty incredible. But it's also the gateway to today's conversation. There are multiple facets to the term prison in this conversation. One which is a physical prison, and one which is the mental prison, the one that Craig had created for himself. Now, the emotional turmoil of that mental prison was one that was less forgiving than a federal correction facility. And it was one that eventually drove him to the point of contemplating suicide. He confessed his thoughts of suicide to his father, and the response that elicited was largely unexpected. The old adage that freedom is a right and not a privilege only rings true until you lose those freedoms. Time is a gift. Freedom is a privilege. And reinvention is Craig's new reality. So join me as we unlock those prison gates to my conversation with Craig Stanland. Hey, Craig, welcome to the podcast. We were talking off air just minutes ago, before I actually hit the record button on today's recording, about how I first heard you, as we've discussed before, on the James Altucher Show, and how amazing this platform is in regards to it enabling people that don't know each other, that naturally wouldn't normally connect, to have these types of conversations. I mean, naturally, our paths, so many things would have to happen for our paths to cross. But this is what's so beautiful, I think, about this platform. It's a real enabler. You know, I'm not going to be able to pick up the phone just randomly and ask someone to tell me about their story, because I just want to satisfy this natural curiosity I have for other people's stories.
It doesn't compute. It doesn't work.
It doesn't. And just filling in some of the gaps for the audience, from what we spoke about earlier, was also the fact that this is like a childhood ambition of mine. You know, I wanted to be a music producer / DJ. Didn't really work out because I didn't really have that kind of talent. And now being able to kind of apply so many years worth of life experience to kind of engage in conversations like this is something that feels like it's a childhood ambition. It really does.
Well, don't you think that is, you know, and James talks about this, but I remember you said you're 40?
Tomorrow.
Oh, happy early birthday. That's awesome.
Thank you.
So yeah, I mean, turning 40, I'm 47, and I feel that, you know, as I hit my 40s, you know, I was like thinking about what I liked as a kid, you know, and James talks about that and going back to those things. You know, I loved writing as a kid, but then, you know, your parents and the influence of people how are you going to make money off of writing? You know, how is that? That's not a career. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, that's something silly that a kid does. Mm. Is write stories and those things. But now that I'm able to get back to that and just realize how much I love it, and that you doing the podcasting and being able to go back to, and I think that's part of the secret of life and the evolution of life is to be able to connect with, and it might not be exactly what we did as kids, but it's something, some derivation thereof that then brings us that joy and fulfillment that oftentimes I feel like starts kicking in the 40s.
Absolutely. And I think it's having all those years behind you where, and this is a strange analogy, but I do like applying this, is there's that symbolic image of a cherub with a harp. And I think as you're younger and you get older, the things that interest you, you're kind of creating these strings inside of you. And these strings, I think, develop inside of you as you gain more experience, you see the world, you learn things. And then at a point where you kind of hit that, I guess that 40s, which is where I'm venturing into now, something plucks one of those strings and that resonates inside you. It just does something that kind of just wakes something else up. I don't know if that makes sense. It's probably a dreadful analogy.
That was a beautiful analogy. It made perfect sense for me, and I'm honestly going to probably borrow that. I'll give you full creative credit, but my mind is turning because there's something, like you said, there's a string inside of us. And if it just gets plucked the right way and resonates, you know, that's when we're in alignment with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's where we feel that joy and fulfillment. And, you know, when we first spoke, which was just an incredible conversation, but it's getting to that place of alignment, the money follows, you know, and I think that's the mindset shift, as opposed to leading with what's going to pay me, what's going to make money, to what brings me joy, with the trust that the money is going to follow, you know. And it's such a empowering place to be, as opposed to that chasing money, because A, it's never going to be enough. And if you're chasing, you know, for me, how are you going to be at peace if you're chasing? You're always running after something. That to me is not a peaceful place to be. But if I'm doing something I genuinely enjoy, that's in alignment, that, you know, resonates that string inside, then I'm good right where I am. And I don't need to be chasing, and I don't need to be grasping at straws and going after things.
Absolutely. And, you know, when you're doing something you really enjoy, then you realize there are non-monetary ways of meeting certain objectives.
Absolutely. It made me think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, some of the basic ones, the food and the shelter, those require money. And once we have that set, then we can start looking at some of those other needs. And they don't have to generate an income. They don't have to generate revenue. They bring intrinsic joy, just the act of doing them. You know, they are autotelic. That you enjoy doing them for the sake of doing them.
Also because you're hoping that they will bring value to the people around you, friends, family, people listening to this podcast. You know, for me, I find it immensely fulfilling to be able to deliver some value, things that people can learn from. And, you know, sometimes you need a life quake. Something has to change for you to press the reset button on your general direction in life and the things around you, to get that new perspective. And I think that's a good segue, Craig, to go in heavy. And that's where I want to go on your story is, I naturally just wanted to start this conversation around your TEDx talk. And for me, just the setting the balance of the scales for this conversation was around exploring the notion of, is it right or is it wrong? And it, to me, this brings me to your moral compass. And often our moral compass is something that is defined from our upbringing, our parents, the path that they put us onto. And I just want to wind back to your TEDx talk. There was a comment around the fact that when you were very suicidal, that you'd come to confess to your father about how you'd felt at that time. And then you'd had another phone call with him a few weeks later where just off the cuff, he told you that he loved you. And that really resonated with me because, you know, I have a fantastic relationship with my dad, and it's taken him a long time to say those types of words because, you know, men of that generation, they're not words that come to them easily, because the likelihood is they're not words that they've had said to them by their own fathers, because that was then a different generation of man. And so for me to hear that kind of emotionally resonated with me for a couple of reasons. One, it kind of reminded me of my dad, that it took him a long time to say those words. And now he says them often, which I think is quite sweet. But it's also me being a father myself. And one of the things that I tell my kids all the time is that I love you no matter what. That if you do something stupid or you fail to do something, we're still going to love you. But I always looked at that, Craig, as that was an instinctive thing that a parent says to their children. And I never really focused on why I said that. And I know people will probably think, well, you're, as parents, you just say these things, but there has to be a reason. And it only resonated with me after listening to your TEDx talk, because it was, and these are the words that your father used, was, I love you because you have value to me. And I struggled to say those words without choking, because it made me realize why I tell my children that. And where I'm going with this is I'm curious about a couple of things, because as I said, your parents define your moral compass, you know, and it feels as though some magnetic force, well, the magnetic forces that were pulling on your moral compass were the things that you were materially gaining from the fraud, the money that you were making. But I'm curious around that conversation with your father. How did that make you feel at that time?
When he told me that he loved me because I had value to him, I will tell you, you just saying what you said, it's hard for me not to choke up. And it was, when he said that, it was one of the most meaningful moments of my life. It's like a weight was lifted off of me. It was, I know that my family has forgiven me, and they've forgiven me for years, but that really was a defining moment of my father's forgiveness for what I had done and just the genuine love that he had for me. And it would have been incredible just to hear those words, because as you were saying, it's not something that we hear from our fathers because of the generation that they are from. And, you know, I know that my father loves me. You know, I know that just in the way that he acts and the way that he speaks, but I can't remember the last time he said those words. And so he could have just said, I love you. And that would have been one of the most meaningful moments. But he substantiated it with, you have value to me. And that really was, that was such a defining moment. That was to be, you know, not just to say it, but to put weight behind it, to add a why to it, was huge. And I feel that the arrest changed my relationship with my family in general. But from that moment on with my father, that redefined our relationship as well. And it's just been even closer and even tighter since then. It just, you know, opens up that, it's like that, almost like that weight that we all have. And once you get it out there, everything is more open and more free, and you can just communicate easier. And I think that's something that we've been able to do, which is really, it's really been a beautiful thing to witness and experience.
Things many people, Craig, can go a whole lifetime without, not just without hearing those words, but substantiating why behind it. And I think that was what was so powerful from that statement. And the thing that I guess I'm curious about was, how critical was your parents' support during this period?
So there's one thing I'd love to touch on before I answer that. It just came to me crystal clear why that was so important and the substantiation. I believe we as humans, some of the most, maybe two of the most important things to us, and we don't even realize this, I think, all that much, is to be seen and to be heard. Mm. And when my father said that you have value to me, he heard what I was saying. And I think that was what made it so unbelievably powerful. And then to get to what you were saying, and I want to make sure I get it correct. It was more just asking how my family, you know, my moral compass and how they, you know, they were, oh, their support rather. Their support was so critical. I have a hard time imagining going through what I went through without the support of my family. My mother and father were nothing short of extraordinary. My sister was unbelievable. My aunt, everybody stepped up in such a way that it made it possible to go through, especially with all those suicidal thoughts that I was having. I mean, they were just their love and their support and their forgiveness. You know, my aunt, for example, you know, I would always apologize. And she said, what are you apologizing for? You have no reason to apologize. She gets, you know, she would laugh. She goes, you didn't do anything to me. You did it to yourself, but you didn't do anything. She's like, I want you to know you didn't do anything to me. I said, you know, I hurt the family. She's like, the family is going to be fine. Don't worry about that. You have to worry about yourself. And it was just, you know, things like that and different perspectives that were so important.
Families recover, you know, so when damage is created in whatever shape or form, be it reputational or depending on the dynamics of every family's dynamics are different. And I think that's just something that I could feel it from what you were saying. I didn't even really have to ask you these questions, Craig. I think it came through in the TEDx talk. I was just curious about certain areas. But to me, you know, I could instantly tell that your family support was crucial.
Absolutely crucial. You know, the visits, getting visits in prison, very, very difficult. It's there's two aspects to it, filled with shame that your family has to come visit you in prison, but unbelievably excited that you're going to have human contact. Mm. You're going to have a hug. You're going to have a handshake. You're going to be in touch with the outside world that you can only see, but you can't actually touch. You're going to have a glimpse of the outside world inside prison. So for them to make the drive, which was pretty significant for them, you know, it was an investment of time and energy to come to prison, but for them to do it as much as they did, it made such a difference, such a difference.
And your father, he was a lawyer, wasn't he?
He is still a lawyer. He retired after 49 years with the same company. And he still practices law. He's a patent attorney and he still practices. And I love this about my dad. And I think this is something I hope that I retain when I'm his age. He's 82. He still practices because he loves it, but also because he wants to remain relevant. Hmm. And he knows that if he's not using his brain, what could be waiting for him? So he practices, you know, it's funny. He'll still complain on occasion. You know, hey, Dad, how's the garden going? Because that's his hobby. He loves gardening. He's got basically the Brooklyn Botanical Garden in his backyard. And he said, well, you know, I can't spend as much time because I've got all these client calls and everything. I said, you realize you're your own boss, right? You realize you're doing this as freelance work. You can stop whenever you want, right? Yeah, but I like the work. I'm like, okay. But I think I love it.
And I don't want to lose the clients. It's that they have a mindset, I think. You know, in the way they've operated for so many years. And it's like, well, if I don't work with the clients, the likelihood is they might go somewhere else.
that's a great point. You know, I'm going to ask him that. I'm going to ask him that if there's any fear of losing the clients.
Craig, I just want to shift gears and explore some of the mechanics of the fraud itself. And you made a comment earlier around the point at which you first hit the enter button to start the fraud. So tell me more about the process. What was involved? How did the fraud itself work?
It was, so you've got routers, Cisco sales routers and switches. You know this, but for the listeners, routers and switches are essentially a box that cards slide into. Those cards have different functionality for whatever you want them to do within the network. You buy a warranty that covers the entire box and every card that goes in that box. When a card dies, you can create a TAC case with Cisco, and they will send you a brand new component, a replacement piece, and you send them the faulty one back. So what I realized what I could do was I could buy my own router. Mm-hmm. It was empty, and I could buy a warranty policy on it. I would buy a used piece of equipment, a used card off of eBay or some other channel, usually eBay, and I would create a TAC case. So Cisco would send me a brand new piece and I could send them the used one back. My profit was on the delta between what I paid for the used piece and what I could sell a brand new piece of equipment for. Where I started, I mean, that is wrong unto itself. Where I started getting even worse was I realized I could increase my profit margins by buying what's called third-party manufacturer cards. So they are identical cards, potentially made in the same factory, but they're not Cisco branded. Mm. And you buy those even cheaper, so now I'm increasing my profit margins. Where it gets even muddier beyond that is I started scaling it, and I had created dummy companies that weren't even companies. They weren't properly incorporated or anything. I just came up with fake names and fake aliases. And I had some stuff getting sent to my apartment. I had some stuff getting sent to my wife's store in Brooklyn. I had some of it going to multiple UPS stores. So they were just multiple fake companies, multiple fake aliases, and numerous tax cases being created every single day. And that was the core of it.
And you know, the scaling of it, were you scaling in a smart way? As in, were you trying to cover the bases with how you were scaling, or were you just looking to kind of scale out with more drop-off areas, putting in more orders?
It was scaling not in a good way. Mm. It was, oh, wow, this is working. How can I make it work even more? Mm. And I won't even say better. How can I make it work more? How can I get more out of this? Oh, great.
And faster.
Right. And I also, it was scaling for the monetary aspect of it. And it was also scaling because I felt like I can't keep calling in the same serial number. So I need multiple serial numbers. I need multiple contracts to be able to break it up so that it's, you know, not just two routers that keep continually getting called in, because I knew that that would be a red flag. Mm.
But you know, those red flags, what, you know, looking at it from in hindsight, what obvious red flags were you excluding from your reality?
Well, the one with my heart chiming in, that was a big one. But then there were the externals. And the externals were, there was a time one of the people who worked at the UPS store said to me that a postal inspector had come and was just asking questions about me. Mm. And that made me so paranoid and so nervous. And this will give you an idea of my mindset. What I did to counteract that was, oh, I'm just using fake names. I'll just put everything in my name then. And I just switched. I said, that's all that is. I'll just switch. You know, I told my accountant when I was going through all of this, you know, he looked at me. He said, is this right? Are you sure this is right? No, it's fine. My wife, who had no idea about the intricacies of everything, but her continually asking, is this right? One of the restaurants that we used to go to regularly, he being the manager, was very coy about it, but he kind of said, boy, you'd be amazed, you know, at what our government does, you know, what the FBI does. You know, they will subpoena somebody's receipts for what they ate on a certain day, and they will ask for numerous copies of numerous times that the person's been here. And I didn't.
Nothing.
I thought he was just telling me a funny anecdote.
Didn't register at all.
Didn't register at all until I was at sentencing and the prosecution brought forth those receipts and went through them at sentencing in a courthouse saying what I ate, that I had the spaghetti bolognese, that I ordered a bottle of Purple Angel wine, that I had tiramisu for dessert, that I had octopus for the appetizer. And then all of a sudden it really did click. I said, oh, wow. That guy was warning me.
They could have been tracking you for ages, following you, observing you.
My understanding is about 6 months. My fraud was about 10 months. Hmm. And I think they were on to me.
Quite quickly.
Quite quickly.
That's not much time at all. No.
No.
Interesting.
They, being Cisco, they have a fraud detection team whose people, their job is to track things like this. And I don't know this for a fact, but I'd be so shocked if they didn't have AI just running in the background and capturing how many cases are being opened. What are the cases being opened for? I also got, because I'd scaled it to a sense so large and I was such an efficiency machine, I used the same language basically for every technical case that I opened. Mm. It was a cut and paste, which was a huge red flag.
Those patterns would be quite easy to then pick up. And yeah. And the so I understand the process, so you were effectively you'd procured yourself a series of switches that you were then claiming warranty claims back to Cisco to say they were broken. They would provide a replacement switch, which you would then sell on at eBay at a margin, and you were effectively cycling back on your own switches over and over again.
That is a perfect synopsis of what I was doing.
Brilliant. That makes me sound really, really smart. Love it, Craig. I want to just explore reality, because to me, it feels as though you'd created your own reality to make it feel as though what you were doing was acceptable, that it was legal. And the reason I ask that, Craig, is I've listened to other talks from yourself and other interviews that you've done. And it kind of feels like you did this with what you thought were legal intentions, because you paid your taxes. You kept intrinsic records. So you made the forensic accounting really easy for the FBI. And usually criminals do everything they can to cover their back to stop themselves getting caught. But when I look at those, signals, Craig, to me, it feels like it was somebody that either didn't accept what they were doing was illegal, or just thought it was legal and was happy just to go. It kind of felt like that person was in denial.
I would go with denial. I believe it was denial. I knew the second that I hit that enter button to start the entire fraud, something inside me told me that this isn't right and not to do it. But I had, you're right, constructed my own reality where I was on this total or in this total gray area. Mm. And, you know, I didn't know. It sounds so weird for me to say it now, but I didn't know it was illegal, but I knew it wasn't right. Mm. And so I was in that gray area, and I lied to myself. I lied to my wife. I lied to my family. And just as the fraud got larger and larger, the weight and the magnitude of it grew. And I did fight that reality. Mm. I really fought that reality. I had hit at one point, my fraud had crossed the $1 million mark. And when that happened, and I realized, I did the math, I did a quick calculation in my head, and it was as if I was having a heart attack. I've never had a heart attack, but I imagine that's what it felt like, because it was a fist clenched my heart and squeezed with all of its might to just yell at me and say, this is not right. And I kept going.
Why did you keep on going?
It got so big that I didn't know how to stop it. And it had become, it was fueling my lifestyle. It was maintaining my extravagant dinners and my large purchases of nice watches and, you know, dresses and shoes for my wife and just our very luxurious lifestyle. It was fueling that. And my identity was so inextricably tied to that I couldn't dare let that go, because I wouldn't know who I was going to be without it. And I was deathly afraid that, you know, my wife would not accept me as is without these things. I later now can see how foolish that was, and that her love for me was genuine. But I really didn't know who I was outside of my things. And I had to prop this house of cards up no matter what.
And, you know, often people like myself think that white collar crimes can be victimless, you know. So this is a large corporation. And, you know, and I remember you saying previously that when the FBI had asked Cisco, you know, is this a big deal for you guys? You know, is this a big fraud? And the guy was like, no, it's not a big deal at all. So just hearing that, you think, okay, well, Cisco didn't get impacted by what Craig had done. But when you talk about your wife, this wasn't a victimless crime, was it?
What a wonderful way to say that. And it really was not. It is throwing a stone into a still pond, and the ripples reach much further than we realize. And it was my wife. It was damage to myself. And it was also the written yet unwritten rule of, you know, we're not supposed to break the law. You know, I mean, that's something that we know, but there's something that's, it's, I went against society and what is good for society and the community in general. You know, there are many people that I have spoken to that say, I don't see what the big deal is. They are, you know, whatever, maybe a $50 billion market cap or whatever it may be. Like, you know, this is ridiculous. And I will say, no, I was wrong because I went against our society and our rules and our laws. And, you know, let's also, I mean, I could take it as far as I took up court space and court time and prosecutor's time and the judge's time. You know, I mean, there is really a tremendous amount of ripple effect. What if there was another case that was way more important than mine, but mine was on the docket beforehand? You know, there's just a lot of things that take place and that it impacts.
I just want to explore the day of the arrest. So how did the day itself unfold? And were there any heightened warnings now in hindsight that were indicators that something was going to happen on the day that it happened?
There was no clue. There was no tip-offs. There was no anything. The day started as any other day. I woke up, you know, had some coffee. My wife and I were hanging out. I had just started a new job. Our biggest competitor had wooed me away with a pretty generous pay package. And normally, prior to taking this new job, I worked out of the house. This job required that I drive from our home in Connecticut into Manhattan. So she walks me to the front door. We kiss each other goodbye. I get in the car. I drive. Any other day, I park my car in the garage. I take the elevator up 37 floors. And I get to my desk and I start unpacking my things. And I put my cell phone down and I see that I have a missed call and a voicemail. I said, geez, I was holding my phone the entire time. How did I miss a call? Well, anyway, let me pick it up and listen to it. And it was the following. It said, Mr. Sandlin, this is Special Agent McTiernan with the FBI. We are at your residence and have a warrant for your arrest. You need to call us and come home immediately, or we will issue a warrant with the federal marshals. That was around 8:45 in the morning. It was a Tuesday.
What was your first thought when you listened to that voicemail?
Honestly, the first thought was, it was my heart saying, I told you so. It was my heart saying, I told you so. Then that was immediately followed by what I can only describe as like a vacuum inside of my body, sucking all the air out of the room. I had difficulty finding air to breathe. My stomach, I can't even say it fell to my feet. It felt like it fell those 37 floors that I had just come up. My heart fell. I mean, it was sheer terror. It was just sheer, unadulterated terror.
And I guess what couldn't prepare you for was the moment that you walked into the house. Do you remember anything from the point that you left that office and then you commuted back home?
I remember so much. It was so vivid. And part of that was it was so emotionally charged. So I had gotten that voicemail. I felt sheer terror. And I was afraid to leave the office. I'd only just started this job 2 weeks before. I didn't know everybody's name. Didn't really know anybody's name. And how do I make the excuse that I just walked in and I'm immediately turning around and the new guy is leaving? Yeah. I remember thinking that. I remember coming off the elevator and passing the security desk and seeing the security badge on the gentleman's shoulder and just seeing, you know, this badge. I said, is he going to do something to me? Sounds irrational, but I was just like, whoa, wait a second. I go out I was in Midtown Manhattan and it was busy as could be. And there were sirens in the distance. Are they coming for me? I had to get my car out of the garage. I was convinced that the parking attendant knew that the FBI wanted me. And I was embarrassed that I have to ask for my car when I told him that I was going to be about 9 hours. So he probably buried it in the back somewhere. And here I am 15 minutes later collecting it. I was embarrassed for that. Driving home was sheer panic of not knowing what to go into. My father being an attorney, I called him up to let him know the voice message I had received. I wanted to keep him in the loop. I was fortunate that I had that drive home because I was able to secure representation on the drive home. I don't have a criminal attorney, but at the time I owned four homes, and I had a real estate attorney that I had dealt with. So I called my real estate attorney, told him what was happening. As fate would have it, a white collar attorney actually rents space in their office. So they put me in touch with him. So I was able to secure representation. And the whole drive home was, Bobby, I'll tell you, to your point earlier about accepting reality and the denial that I was in, there was such a big part of me that was saying, it's okay, we'll figure this out when I get home. It's a misunderstanding. We'll sit down, we'll figure it out. It's going to be okay. You know, I was still believing that. And, you know, the whole drive home, calling my wife to see what was going on. Mm. And when she picked up the phone, the pain in her voice and the fear in her voice, she just said, Craig, what's happening? And I couldn't answer her. I could not, because I didn't know. And no idea what she was dealing with, had no idea. You know, I knew why they were there, but I didn't know what they were doing there. And it was just, you know, to reiterate, it's just that sheer terror of the unknown, of uncertainty.
What's interesting is that you still thought that you could spin the same story that you've been spinning to yourself and to everybody else, even at the point of no return.
It was, yeah, I mean, what a great way of saying it, the point of no return. And here I am still in complete denial. And in a sense, thinking I'm so slick that I can talk my way out of the FBI sitting at my house executing a search warrant.
And, you know, I find that so compelling, Craig, because being in the UK, the view that we have of the FBI is what we see in the films. And I want to understand if it is very much like we see in the films. So the moment when you pulled up at that driveway, and what were the cars that were parked outside? Were they the blacked out SUVs, or what was outside the house before you stepped in?
It looked like a movie scene. It absolutely looked like everything you've seen in the movie. So I lived in a gated community. I went through my gate, took a right-hand turn down the hill. As soon as I took that right-hand turn, everything came into view. There were probably close to 15 vehicles. Mm. They were the blacked out cars. They were local police cars there. There was something that almost looked like a SWAT vehicle that was there. They were all standing outside. We had the local police were there in their regular uniforms, but then the FBI guys were in the blue jackets with the yellow lettering, wearing gray suits, blue suits, you know, very, very boring FBI suits. And they looked exactly like you would think that they do in the movies. And they were a well-oiled machine. So as I was coming down the hill, they kind of formed a line with their bodies to guide my car into what wasn't even a parking spot, but it was, put your car here. Then when I went to open my car door, they were not forceful about it, but they put their bodies in such a way that I couldn't swing open the door suddenly to maybe attack or pull something out. They controlled my movement of the car door with their bodies. And the moment that I stood up, an agent, he couldn't have been any more of an agent, had the high and tight haircut, had the boring staid tie with the gray suit. And he just said, identify yourself. Mm. And just said with, you know, such a military precision. And, you know, Craig Stanlin, turn around. We're going to frisk you. Turn back around. And they frisk me again. Empty the contents of your pockets into the front seat. And a gentleman comes running over with Ziploc bags and a marker and starts collecting evidence. And it was very efficient.
So at that moment then, they started collecting that evidence, and then I guess you were escorted into the house.
No. So this is interesting. I was not allowed in my house. I was not allowed to see my wife. They needed to ensure there was no co-conspiracy. Mm. So to make sure there was no hidden communication in between us. So I wasn't even close to my front door. is actually they kept us so far away. There was a courtyard between us. I have no idea what she was going through. The people that were still in our home. Yeah, it was scary. I asked to see her and they said, no, completely not allowed.
So at that point you were arrested and then taken away.
They pulled out the handcuffs and I asked them, I said, please don't handcuff me. And for the listeners, I'm all of 5'4". At the time, I weighed about 140 pounds. So I'm not a large gentleman. And I said, look at me. I'm clearly not a threat. Don't cuff me. Please don't cuff me. And he said, it's procedure. We have to. And they turned me around and they took my arms behind my back and snapped them on. And they were the sound of handcuffs going around your wrist is one of the most visceral sounds that you could imagine. And they were much heavier than I thought. They had such a weight to them. And part of the reason I didn't want them to go on is I knew that I had already come to the end, but that was the true mental end in my mind.
Symbolically, that was the first point at which you were effectively contained. You know,
correct.
Something locked you at that point. And it's funny you mentioned how they felt, because it's exactly what I was going to ask you next. Because I was intrigued around how did it sound and how did it feel, which you've answered. But, and I think, yeah, it's something quite symbolic about that. And, you know, and for me, Craig, we've got kind of similar backgrounds. You know, we're fortunate enough to have, good parents that have kind of put us on straight and narrow and have kind of provided us with that moral compass. But those handcuffs are quite symbolic, because I think any parent who's raised children in the right way is something they would never think would be around the cuffs of their children.
There's something so visual to it, to see your, I would have to imagine, to see your child contained in that way. Handcuffs are so restrictive, and having your arms behind your back, it's defenseless. May sound irrational, because I can't imagine the FBI would have struck me for any reason, but it did dawn upon me that if somebody wanted to punch me, there is nothing I can do. If I fall, if I trip, there's nothing I can do. I'm falling on my face. It's just a very helpless and very hopeless feeling.
So you're in denial up to this point, and I assume even after this point. Yeah. So when you were read the charges, were you completely surprised? Did they come as a surprise? Did you have any idea what kind of charges you would be read?
I had no idea. And I don't think I had ever heard of the term mail fraud. I'd heard of wire fraud, but I had never heard of mail fraud. And that was, you know, I didn't know what the heck that was. I understood from the context of it and from what I was doing, but I didn't even know what it was. And it was one charge. And I do remember thinking, like, well, it's only one charge. Why? What is this such a big deal? I don't know, you know, if there was supposed to be, thinking of the magnitude of what I was doing, you know, thank God there weren't more than one charge. But I was like, how does this one charge have just a blanket over the magnitude of what I was doing? And I had asked so after they put the handcuffs on me, they put me in the back of one of those black tinted out cars. And there was an agent in the front seat and there was an agent in the back seat. And they started to ask me questions. And I said, can I see the warrant? Can I see the arrest warrant, the search warrant? And the agent said to me, he's like, what do you need to see this for? You're not going to understand it. And I'm telling the story because it ties into the denial that you were saying that I was still experiencing. I flash back to being a kid in high school and getting a parking ticket. And if the parking attendant had made a mistake on your license plate or the color of your car or something minor, the $5 ticket gets thrown out of court. So in high school, we would always get the ticket and we would look through to see if they made an error so we can avoid paying the $5. That flashed to me. I said, boy, can I find something in this document that's going to get me out of these cuffs and get me out of the back of this car? And he kept the cuffs on me, so I had to flip through the pages himself, tell me when to turn. And he was right. I had no idea what I was looking at. I had no clue. And the thickness of the documents, that weighed on me, because I realized they put a lot of work into this. This is substantial. When he was holding, you know, close to maybe an inch of paperwork. And I said, whoa, you know, that's a lot.
And what's interesting about that, and just kind of touching back to what we mentioned before about it not being a victimless crime, is just in my mind, I'm getting a view of the scale of resource from the authorities that was involved in closing down on you. So there's all that work. There's the resource of the federal authorities, the police, where potentially they could have been doing other things, stopping a terrorist incident, something else that could have potentially saved lives. And I think that's where you can just get it. And the reason that, you know, the thickness of that file feels important is that, again, is something else that shows the amount of resource and time that went in to closing down on you. So again, when you start to scale out white collar crime and saying, hey, it's not victimless, there is, and as you mentioned before, a whole chain of other things that could well be dependent on those resources that are being used on you.
Absolutely. It's absolutely. And it's time and resources. Mm. I mean, you said it, that's exactly right. And it's, I was in the system and I don't think I understand the magnitude of how many people were actually working on this, how many analysts and researchers and agents, and let alone the prosecutor, the paralegals that support the prosecutor, the secretaries that support. I mean, it just goes down and down and down and reaches so unbelievably far. Mm. And I think, I don't know why some people like to say it's a victimless crime. And I think the perpetrator likes to say that so he can play the victim and get away with it. And, you know, I can understand that, but society somehow, I don't know if there's a romanticism about it or something where we want to say it's a victimless crime and, you know, there's so much worse things going on with the world. Why are we bothering these people? But again, it's everything that we just said. It's the time and the resources that we really have to think about. And I, in a sense, was very fortunate that my wife and I did not have children. You know, I was away with people who did have children. So talk about victims where the father is away for, you know, in the instance of my two best friends, 8 and 12 years.
And what's also interesting is that even at the point that you were sitting in that blacked out FBI SUV, is in your mind you were still looking for loopholes. And, you know, where they may have done something wrong or they've got me on the wrong offense. But what was that first conversation like with your attorney at the time? Was this very much a, look, Craig, this is a clear cut. You know, you did wrong. There's not really much way of maneuvering around this. Or was it a different conversation to kind of look at loopholes?
I love this question. So my very first conversation with him was at the arraignment, and that was to get me out on bail. And that was a very short conversation. He told me what to do. The second conversation is when we got into the details that you are talking about. He was, plead guilty, because otherwise you're going to be in even more trouble. Mm. If you fight this, the government doesn't like when you fight cases, and they're going to give you the maximum sentence that they possibly can if you fight it and you're found guilty, which you're going to be found guilty. I, on the other hand, was, let me see that inch of paperwork and go through it and dissect it piece by piece. And there were errors in there. Mm. There were errors. There were things that were not right. And I would, you know, highlight them and say to my attorney, I'd say, you know, Gene, look, this isn't right. This sentence isn't right. This isn't right. And he just had to sit there and go, it doesn't matter. You were wrong. You're guilty.
It's immaterial.
It's immaterial. Mm. Part of the victim role that I had was they made mistakes. They did things. Why did we ignore them? And when I accepted responsibility, I realized how immaterial they were to the case, that it didn't make any difference. It would not have even impacted my sentence. You know, I mean, they were just such small errors.
And you know, if you'd fought it and didn't take the plea on it, what would the max sentence have been?
I had a range of, based on the dollar amount, based on my criminal past and the number of victims. There's actually a chart that they use, you know, put all that information into a chart and it spits out a range. So I had a range of 27 to 33 months that I was looking at. I ended up getting 24 months. So I did well in that. That's the suggested range. There are instances where a judge, if she or he, I or she, you know, if she wants to send a message, she could have said 48 months.
Mm.
You know, and that is something that's a very real possibility.
So how long did, so from the point that you were on bail to the point that you then were sentenced, and how long was that period of time?
10 months.
10 months. And then from sentencing to going into prison, was that more or less immediate, or was there also a time lapse there?
There was. So from arrest to actually walking into prison was 10 months. I was sentenced probably, or pled guilty, about 4 months after the arrest.
Okay.
Then sentencing was 4 months after that, give or take, if I remember correctly. It was about 4 months after that. And then, yeah, so it was about 4, 4, and 2. So after sentencing, I had 2 months to get ready before going into prison.
In regards to this becoming a federal offense, is that because it crossed state lines? So parts were being shipped from one state to another. What was the definition?
That is my understanding of it. It was because I was using the official count that I pled guilty to was mail fraud. Mm-hmm. And mail fraud covers not only the post office, but DHL, FedEx, UPS, you know, any courier, if you will. And it was because it was going across the state lines. And it was also probably some of this stuff was probably even coming internationally.
How does that change the dynamic of the offense? So let's just say you operated this within a state and you didn't go out of state. Would that have changed the prison you ended up in, the sentence you got? What would have been the difference in the impact?
To be honest, the only thing that I can say definitively, it would have impacted the prison that I went to. If it was a state offense, here in the States, you know, we've got federal prisons and state prisons. If it was a state offense, I would have gone to a state prison, which would have been quite difficult for me. You know, the federal system has different levels. You've got what is where I went, which is camp, which is the bottom. Then you have what's called a low. Then you have a medium. Then you have high security penitentiary.
And I guess, depending on the state that you committed the offense, there are probably some states that you may have been better off in a local prison versus some other states.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So like you say, you were kind of better off that it was a federal offense that you ended up in a federal prison as opposed to a local prison there.
I was much better off. There's one thing that I can never complain about is the prison that I went to. My physical prison was fine. And in fact, it was almost kind of pretty because of the sunrises, because of the sunsets. It was landscaped nicely. Weather permitting, we ate lunch on picnic tables outside. You know, we were in the middle of upstate New York. It was quite pleasant. And we had deer, we had geese, we had a couple of stray cats that were, you know, it was great. The deer almost ate out of our hands. I had a goose who had a broken wing I worked in the kitchen, so I had access to food, but it was a highlight of my day to go feed him, to call him and watch him waddle over to me and feed him. And so all things considered, I was in a very safe environment. I was with other white collar offenders. I was with nonviolent drug offenders. My safety was never a concern. You know, the physical part was really,
it was quite pleasant,
really quite good.
It seems quite scenic. So you had woodlands. What was the, was it fairly large grounds?
It was extremely large grounds. I don't even know how many acres there were, but it was extremely large grounds. I was so fortunate that we didn't have a fence. We knew not to go into the woods. Mm-hmm. Go into the woods, then you're charged with escape.
Ah, okay.
So that was
a virtual boundary.
It was a virtual boundary. So to not have that fence was really quite nice. We did, it was somewhat of a reminder, in the States, if you have a federal prison camp, it is almost always tied to a medium security facility. So we had a beautiful view, maybe 320 degrees around us, let's say. But then in that remaining piece was the medium security prison, which has the 30-foot high fences with the barbed wire and the razor wire with the guard towers. And that was always, that was a reminder in a sense of where you were, to see that in the distance.
You mentioned there was 4 months between the being sentenced and actually going in prison. Is that right? Or did I get that wrong?
It was 4 months between pleading guilty and sentencing, and then 2 months from sentencing to going to prison.
Okay. So the point at which that gavel then hit, and then you were sentenced and knowing that you were going to prison at that point, I think you mentioned that there was 2 months between that time period, which I guess allowed you to kind of just transition whatever you needed to do in the normal world to before you kind of entered prison. But I'm curious about day one journey. You know, how did you leave the house? How did you get to prison? Who took you there? And what were your first experiences of walking through those prison gates?
It was one of the hardest days of my life. And, you know, my wife and I woke up and we looked at each other and just, you know what the day is. And we held each other a little bit and we cried and, you know, went about getting ready and showering and getting dressed. Was waiting for my stepmother and my father to come pick us up. They would be the ones driving us to prison. So while we were waiting, I, you know, said goodbye to my cat and dog. And she was a 16-pound Westie, and they found about a month prior, 2 weeks prior, something like that, they found a grapefruit-sized tumor in her body and a 16-pound dog. And they had given her a very short amount of time to live. So as I was hugging her, I thought that was the last time I'd see her. And, you know, same with my cat. My cat was already a little bit older at that point. So I thought, you know, maybe this is the last time I see my cat. And my wife and I walk out the door, and I think this is the last time I'm ever going to see this home, because I owe federal restitution. There's a lien. The government has a lien on my mortgage. So although the deed is in my name, I technically don't own it. If I sell it, all proceeds go to the government. So I said, it's not even my home, and I'm not going to see it ever again. And we get in my stepmother's car, and we just start making the drive. It was about 2 hours from our home in Connecticut to the prison in upstate New York. As we're driving along, the conversation is just awkward and stilted. My wife, even with all the damage I had done, she still loved me. It was still caring for me, and she had brought food. And she was telling me I had to eat because I actually lost about 30 pounds. The day I checked into prison, I weighed 109 pounds. I graduated high school at 115.
Wow.
So it was less than I graduated high school. So she was trying to feed me. And finally, we get to the entrance of the prison. We drive all the way up and we come to the camp. I look around and I say, wow, this isn't that bad. And somebody explained to us, no, this isn't where you check in. You have to go over there. And they point to the medium security prison. So we drive there and I say goodbye to my stepmom and my dad out in the parking lot. And I ask for them to keep an eye on my wife and to care for her and whatever she needs, please just take care of it. And my wife and I go into the lobby and I check in almost like a hotel, you know, giving my last name, and they tell me to sit, and she and I hold hands and tears are pouring down our face. And finally the guard comes out and he says, Stanland, say your goodbyes. It's time to go. So we hug and we kiss. And I'll never forget, I watched her go out one door as I was going in another door. And I said, we're both walking through doors, but into completely new and separate lives. I went in and I got processed, which was a difficult, a difficult thing to go through. That was the strip search, which I had already been strip searched by the marshals before that, so I knew it was coming, but it still doesn't make it any easier. They locked me in a holding cell. It was in the basement of this medium security facility, and I was locked in a holding cell and fingerprinted and DNA and the strip search and all of that. And then here I am in the basement of this extremely frightening and ominous place. And it's time to actually go to the camp. And we reverse our way back out. We go out the very door that my wife and I walked into, out into the parking lot. And I was processed with another inmate that was going to be going into the camp. So there were two of us. And the guard says, he says, "Okay, see that rock? Yeah. I'm going to walk to that rock, take a right, you're at the camp. Don't go off path or we'll shoot you." And he laughs as he says that. He chuckles. And we both look at each other and we look at him like we just went into this such a scary, ominous place. And now we're being told to walk freely to go report to where we actually are going to prison. It was so bizarre to us. And he repeated, he said, "Just stay on the path and you're not going to get shot." So we go up. As soon as we walk up, we're greeted by people. And they know, the inmates know when a new inmate is coming in. It's written on a board, so they know who's coming in. So we were greeted by people, and I was met by my mentor, this gentleman, Ed, his mid-60s or so. He couldn't have been any nicer. People were so nice to me, and they were nice to the other guy. Mm. They made sure that we had toothpaste and shampoo and soap, because the prison doesn't actually provide that, and you don't have access to commissary. So there is a tradition in, I believe, most prisons where there's a collection and somebody keeps it for new people coming in so that they can bathe and they have some basic essentials before their commissary is set up. And then the point being, once your commissary is set up, you put back in what you were given for the next person. So I had my things. And I realized, looking around and how nice everybody was in my setting, I realized that I was safe and that my physical safety was not going to be a concern. And I'll tell you, that was one of the best nights sleep that I had had in 10 months, because it was over. Obviously my prison sentence was just beginning, but all that uncertainty was over and I slept really, really well.
There's two things that stand out for me from that. And I think the first thing is the community that you're walking into. So as you said, the I think it was commissary where everybody kind of chips in to provide the new guy with a basic set of essentials. And I think that's something that's quite significant, as in, I guess immediately you must have felt like you're going to be looked after in here.
Yes. Yes. I mean, what a great insight. There was somebody brought me when I first got in, they brought me a cup of coffee as I'm sitting across from my mentor. This strange person just says, "Here, have some coffee. Enjoy. Do you want some powdered cream?" Just caring for that. "Here are your essentials. Here's how this works. Here's how that works." Just very caring, maybe because they had gone through it and they know the same uncertainty and the fear that they felt. So there was a bit of empathy, but there is a strong prison community, and it was really nice to see. And there's such a diverse group of people, but in a sense, who you were on the outside doesn't mean anything when you're all wearing prison greens and you're all a number and your last name. We're all equal. It's a great equalizer.
I guess there's something significant about the word equalizer, because you mentioned it was your first good night's sleep in
10 months.
But you were, whatever happened after day one in prison was effectively the beginning of whatever you make it from that point. As in, did it feel like you were back in control of your life? Because the 10 months before that, everything was kind of, you'd lost everything. Things were in the control of other people. You didn't know where you were heading, how long you were heading for, and also the challenges of relationships, I guess, also with your wife and having maybe difficult conversations on a day-to-day basis. But once you were in prison, you were equalized with everybody else. Day two was whatever you made that day and every day after it.
It really was. And as soon as I realized that I was safe and I had that joy, and we were chatting earlier and you were saying how you're an observer. I am the same way. So I was friendly with people, but I also watched, and that was really my day two. And almost my first couple of weeks was interacting with people, but it was very much, I'm going to observe everything because I want to know how this works. I want to make sure that I don't get in trouble with my fellow inmates, and I don't want to get in trouble with the COs, you know, with the guards. I want to know exactly how everything works. So that was my first foray into that. And that was part of, like you said, I had some control. And part of the way for me to control that was to observe what was going on and to just get the rhythm of the place. You know, there are a lot of rules and caveats, and I'll just give one of them, which is an interesting one. We're counted every day to make sure that nobody has escaped, and we're counted multiple times throughout the day. And you have what's called a standing count, where you have to be in certain places and you're literally standing. They also count you while you're sleeping. You know, you don't have to be awake for that, which is nice. But, you know, to know, to just have this mental note, 10 and 4. And then there's a third count on the weekends during the day that you have to be cognizant of. So it was just one of those things that I was very observant of what happens at the count. Because if you screw up count, you can get into big trouble. And I don't want to screw up the count. So that's just one of the things that I observed. What do people do during this? How can I control this in a sense and make sure that I just do it right?
So that count, you effectively had to be at a certain place at a certain time every day.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. They being the guards, scream out count.
And you know where to go.
Yeah, you know, it's count and boom, you know, there you go. And you line up. It might be in a hallway. It might be at your bunk. But you stand there and wait until you're counted, and you can't. This is another thing that's important that I had to watch. You can't move until it is count cleared or clear count. Guards would say it either way, but then you were free to move about your day, but you can't do anything prior to that. So for that time period, you know, you just have to stand still. And then it's kind of weird. Your number and you're locked down for this time. If there's a mistake in the count, you know, you're standing there for a half an hour if they can't find somebody. Nobody ever escaped, but sometimes they forgot somebody was at a job or at the doctor, you know.
Similar to starting a new job in a new company, there are a couple of things that you do as standard is that you'll find out what the rules are. Yeah. Because every corporation, every office has its own set of rules and the way it kind of operates. But also the other element of being successful in the workplace, in the corporate world, is the relationships that you make. And how conscious were you around the relationships with fellow inmates? And did you kind of use your corporate experience to seed out the relationships that either were going to benefit you from either logistically or emotionally? What was the thought process that you used around how you established relationships with other inmates?
I really went with my gut. And there were several people who were unbelievably nice, but I had a very bad feeling about them. Their niceness was phony. And I said, I do not want to be a part of this person's circle whatsoever. And it really came down to that observation and seeing who behaved in certain ways and just knowing who I wanted to associate with. And I kept a little bit of a distance in the beginning, but people would approach me and they really started the friendships, which was great. And, you know, one of my friends, Sal, when I first went in, I was put in what's called the dorm. So there were 16 of us in one room And Sal basically ran the dorm, and he took me under his wing for that time period when I was in that room. And he was just a gregarious, really good guy. And he was friends with so many people. And that opened up a door for me to create the circle that I created. He was respected in there. Like I said, he was such a nice guy. He was a big, big dude, which I think also helped in his status. I mean, he was 6'3", 6'4", 280.
He had a bodyguard.
So I had a bodyguard. It was very funny. People would laugh that, you know, we became best friends and we would walk around all the time. And he literally weighs twice as much as I do. And, you know, they're just like, you should see you two together. But it was listening to him. And also what was interesting was he would corroborate my feelings about the people that I wanted to avoid. You know, he would say, stay away from him. He's up to no good. I said, I thought that. And he goes, well, you're right. So stick with that.
There's so many similarities to that, though, back to the corporate world, where it's how you build your network. You know, the people, as you say, the people that are overtly nice, potentially there's a hidden agenda. You're not sure how to trust people. And you do. And I think I've done this myself, and I'm not trying to draw too many comparisons to just working and prison, but there are sometimes certain individuals that you have sufficient confidence in that you trust their judgment, you know, that they're influential to a point where there'll be some benefit somewhere where you need to make new friends. So just instinctively, it does kind of feel as though whatever you learned in that corporate world was something that helped you transition into building the right network in prison.
I would agree with that. Absolutely. So Sal was a huge part of, you know, meeting everybody, but it was, you know, who can I meet in here that I can learn from? You know, I'm with such an interesting group of people. I had when I moved out of the dorm into kind of more the general area, my next door neighbor, if you will, was he had the largest restitution order in the United States prior to Bernie Madoff.
Wow.
And he was a very interesting gentleman. Mm. And it was, I was conscious of, I don't want to use people, but it was a genuine like, boy, I'd like to talk to him. You know, that's something very interesting. My bunkie, who I shared my cell with, was one of the most interesting men I've ever known in my entire life. And I was so fortunate that I got matched up with him. And, you know, it was that having that corporate background really did help in those instances. It helped. And it also, I don't want to say hindered, but there was a separation because between the billionaire next door and my bunkie, who was of such, his family has hospitals named after them. You know, I mean, okay. He's built buildings where I.M. Pei was his architect.
Interesting,
right? So I mean, they were on a bit of a different level. Yeah. So if I sometimes tried to keep up with them on that hierarchy or that structure, I would sometimes get smacked down in a very nice way, you know. But it was kind of like we're on a different level than you. It was very much like a corporate structure, though. It was like we're the C-level executives. Your middle management.
But there's an opportunity to learn. And I think that's quite interesting, is that you're in this environment with other white collar criminals that potentially also have a corporate business background, as you've said, but you also kind of seize an opportunity to learn from them while you're in there.
I learned so much from everybody, and I learned so much from my bunkie because of just, he was in private equity and we'd have great conversations. And I'd learned some really just important things. Some of them were completely ludicrous. For example, very quickly, he told me when I get out, what kind of jet I should never buy a jet. I should only do Netflix because buying a jet is a waste of money. And he said, make sure you get a big enough jet. I said, are you serious? Do you see where we're sitting right now? I said, I didn't even make jet money before I went in. How am I going to have jet money now? And he's like, just shut up and listen. You know, but it was funny just to have these conversations, but learning how private equity worked. He actually had The Berkshire Hathaway annual report, his family sent it to him. And I come back into our cell one time and it's underneath my pillow. And I was like, and with a note, read this and learn. Anything that he handed to me, I read and I learned. It was things like that. I mean, there was definitely opportunities. And really quickly, I'll touch upon the nonviolent drug offenders, some of the nicest people I've ever met as well. And talk about a different kind of learning. You know, I learned from them as well. They were just so intuitive and sharp and just such a level of street smarts that they all very easily could go into the corporate world and do just fine.
You must have learned like 30 years of life experience in that period of time that you were in prison.
I learned a tremendous amount. It was jammed in. And what I find so interesting about that is, so once I got accustomed to where I was, and I feel that you touched upon this a little bit earlier, I didn't have the stress of the marriage. I didn't have the stress of my house and bills. You know, they were all going on, but I had no control over them. So I really did have an opportunity to just sit and learn with an open mind, freed from the constraints of normal real life.
And what's intriguing about that, I think, is, and we've spoken about this before around the term reset, you know, because we, you know, the pandemic is a reset for a reboot for many people and in the outside world. You know, so that whole period for you is a complete reset, reboot, flush the cash, and give you a complete new opportunity and new lens to just do something completely different. But from that, I can immediately sense that you used every opportunity to soak up knowledge, information, networks, as part of that process when you were in there.
I really did. I knew I had to use the time. And there was a turning point for me. There were several turning points, but there was one where I was crushed by my sentence, the weight of my sentence, even though, you know, compared to my friends, it wasn't that long, but I was still crushed by it. And I said, how am I going to make this through? So I did a calculation and I said, I'm 24 month sentence. I came up with a rough estimate of my my estimated age of death of 84. So I did the math and it came out to, I think it was 2.something% of my overall life was going to be in prison. And when I did that, when I saw it on paper, I said, oh, shoot, I can do that. That's nothing. That's such a small percentage over my whole life. I can do this. And then what I was kind of saying before, that I didn't have the bills and I didn't have marriage and just the weight of the outside world on me, this crushing burden, which now I realize that I can make because it's such a small percentage of my overall life. All of a sudden, now I have the gift of time. It did turn into the gift of time where I'm like, wait, I forget when this transformation of time occurred for me mentally. But let's say it was like, well, now I have 14 months left to jam in as much stuff as physically possible while I can. This is a gift of a reset that I have to use to the best of my ability. I actually burnt myself out in prison on self-help. I burnt myself out on it.
Just exploring that for a moment around the reset. So you use the time to absorb knowledge and to learn and shape a different path for yourself. But just for a moment, just exploring the emotional side of the reset as well. Because, you know, you mentioned before that you had to get to a point where you needed to forgive yourself as well. And I'm just curious about the process and the methods you used to realize that. How did you forgive yourself?
Forgiving myself was one of the most important things that I did as part of the reset. And how I was able to do it was, I knew that I had to forgive myself. because otherwise I'd be consumed by shame for the remainder of my life. And I knew the importance of it. And I would try saying I forgive myself, but it didn't stick at all. And I grew to understand that that voice that told me not to hit the enter button had spoke. It spoke every single time I hit the enter button for the 10 months that I committed my fraud. I ignored it for so long that my voice disappeared. I had no trust in myself when I was in prison, and even when I went to the halfway house, and even after I got out of the halfway house, because I had ignored that voice, I did not trust myself. Simple decisions were hard to make because I didn't trust that I would make the right choice. And I'm talking about, what am I going to do at the gym? What am I going to eat? Simplest decisions. I couldn't trust myself. How am I going to forgive myself if I don't trust myself? How am I ever going to believe the words that I forgive myself? So I had to build trust in myself. And the author Kamal Ravikant had put up on Twitter, of all places, the following: "The surest path to self-confidence I know is making and keeping commitments." And I was thinking of trust, but I took that tweet that resonated with me. And I said, you can't have self-confidence if you don't trust yourself. Trust is the foundation of confidence. To trust oneself is to believe in oneself. When you believe in yourself, you have confidence in yourself. So I reverse engineered that statement into, I need to trust myself. So I started making and keeping commitments to myself to rebuild my trust. And that is actually that's how I got to forgiving myself. That was one of the key elements. Another element of that was, since my identity was so inextricably tied to my things and I didn't know that I had worth, even though I realized that I did have worth, I still didn't know who I was and still didn't feel worthy of creating this new life. I had to work on letting myself know that I was worthy and enough. And those are two sides of the same coin. One thing that I did for that was, this might be a silly example, but in my apartment, I have a beautiful balcony. And balconies in New York City are a rare commodity, and mine is huge. To have outdoor space is just, it's a gift. Bobby, I'll tell you, I didn't use my balcony for maybe almost 2 years because I didn't feel worthy of sitting on my own balcony that I paid rent for. I did not feel worthy of going out there. Who am I to have this luxury? And it dawned on me one day, so how am I ever going to trust myself? How am I ever going to forgive myself if I am not worthy of using a balcony that I pay for? So I immediately bought a cheap set on Amazon of furniture, and I decorated it and I started using it. And why that's important was that showed me to what extent I was punishing myself. I was giving myself penance for what I had done. Even after I was done with prison, I was still punishing myself. And decorating that balcony opened up to see other areas of my life where I was denying myself small acts of kindness. And how am I going to be worthy if I'm denying myself, for example, watching TV? I didn't feel worthy of watching TV. I should be consistently working on improving myself. I should consistently be doing things. And so I started watching TV, you know, small things. And that was just, that built up the worth, that built up the trust. Then when I started saying and analyzing what I needed to forgive myself for, I believed it and knew I was worthy of it. And that is, it's a pretty long answer, but it was a pretty long process to get to that point, to be able to forgive myself.
And your commitments, honoring your commitments, effectively feels like your checks and balances on self-trust. So the moment you stop doing that, you fall back into that same cycle.
You could fall back so quickly, and it could be a trap that happens without you even realizing it. You know, and it's something that another thing that I worked on that supports what you just said and what we're talking about right now is when I was in prison, I kept on wishing that I didn't make those choices. So I started saying, is there a filter? Is there a lens that I can run choices through that are going to make them easier? I didn't realize at the time with all the inner work that I was doing, I'd never heard the term core values. But I kept on, when I journaled and when I was writing, I was calling it my filter and my lens. And there's got to be an easier way to make difficult choices. And I wasn't looking for the shortcut. I just knew there has to be a better way where it's just very clear and very delineated. And those, that filter and lens turned into what I realized were core values. And so, you know, when I do have, like you said, not keeping that commitment, does that align with my core values? It doesn't. So I have to stay in alignment with my core values, and it makes keeping that commitment that much easier. You know, that was another huge component.
And you know, the piece around the balcony, and feeling as though you don't deserve the balcony. And do you think some part of that is that you may be tempted back with the things that gave you that good life before? So then let's just say, hypothetically speaking, you know, there's a good paycheck that gives you an opportunity to buy a Rolex watch. And you think, well, you know what, I like the feel of the Rolex watch back on my wrist. Does part of you think that even a taste of elements of the old lifestyle could potentially swing you back into that area of greed again, if that makes sense? I could probably ask that question better, but
I want to just compliment you for how well you did ask that question.
I didn't feel like I
and
did.
Quite frankly, how creeped out I am that you're almost in my mind of how well, how insightful you just were, and how you nailed that on the head. You, and the fact that you use the watch, and I know you know that I like watches. One of my friends at the gym had a Panerai watch, which I was a huge collector of. I loved Panerais. And he saw me looking at it, and he knew I liked watches. He said, do you want to wear it for the day, you know, while I'm training my clients? And I said, yeah, can I? And I put it on. And man, did I feel so good wearing this watch. I felt so good. I felt alive. And the moment that I felt that alive, crushing guilt came in of what was wrong with me before putting this watch on. I was totally fine before this watch. And I took it off and put it in an envelope and put it, hid it behind the gym while he was doing it. But I was like, I can't do this. I'm not worthy of this. It was like a drug. It was like this thing. So yes, the balcony was very much like, I can't extend myself any form of luxury because it's a gateway drug into who knows what else is in there. And I think that's just such a testament to the voice of self-hate that can live in us, where there's nothing wrong with having a really nice watch, as long as it doesn't define who you are, as long as it's not, you're not attached to it, and it's not a symbol of who you are. You know, you want a nice watch and you like it because of the mechanics of it and just the beauty of it, have at it. But I, back in the day, could not do that. And yeah, I mean, you really nailed it.
And you don't want it to be a gateway to further temptation.
Don't want it to be a gateway, because it's, you know, it's how quickly things escalated for me and got out of control. And it was, you know, let's think about it. It kind of relates to that trust piece. Even though I was building the trust within myself, I didn't have it implicitly and deeply at that point. So there was still that thought. If I was to wear a watch right now, it wouldn't have any impact on me. I'd wear it because I would want to wear it, you know. But it's, at that time, it was an interesting observation.
I want to shift gears and discuss anxiety and uncertainty. And I'm curious about the anxiety of going from not knowing when you're going into prison, how long you're going to go into prison for. I guess that at a point where the kind of gavel hits, you know, wood hits wood, and then you know what's destined for you, is that, you know, you've spoken about this before, that as soon as you knew the dates, you knew the sentence, the anxiety had just kind of gone away because there was certainty.
There was certainty in how long I was going to go away for, and then replaced with the, or not even replaced because I still had it, but it became more even the central focus of, where am I going? Mm. What is it going to be like? Am I going to lose my wife? I was already fast forwarding. What am I going to do for money when I am done with this? You know, it was just that uncertainty. But there was some kind of finality when wood hit wood of, okay, I now know something. I don't like it, but I know it. It's no longer this dark cloud of uncertainty following everything. You know, at least I have something tangible that I can hold on to.
It's like transitional uncertainty. So I guess one uncertainty is replaced with a different one that has a different set of emotions. And does that go away? Because I guess even leaving prison, you know, your relationship with your wife had broken down at that point. Then you'd kind of moved into a halfway house. Was that uncertainty then just a different set of uncertainty, not knowing what am I going to do next?
It was probably the most uncertain period of my time, from the moment of the arrest all the way through the entire process. Every single step had its own uncertainty and emotion to it. Mm. And going to the halfway house was something that I really wanted to do, because from the halfway house, you can leave and go to the gym. You can go to do laundry. You can go to the supermarket. You can go to the pharmacy. You can leave. You have a level of freedom. You always have to come back because you're still under the auspices of the Bureau of Prisons, but you have that level of freedom. So I was really excited about that. However, I was going to be going into general population. Mm. And I didn't know what that was going to look like. And before I had secured a job, there was the uncertainty of, how do I get a job? I'm a federally convicted felon. There's a court order barring me from my industry. I can't do that. And who's going to want to hire me anyway? So there was all of those concerns. I didn't have a home. I hadn't secured an apartment. I had no place to live. I had no money. So there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty and fear of, what am I going to possibly do?
And that element of having a federal record, effectively, is, you, as you say, you're then unsure about what the other constraints are around that. Is that something that you've seen so far, even just being able to rent an apartment or something else, have you found having a federal record out of prison something that's kind of put obstacles in the way?
I feel that I am so unbelievably fortunate for how things have evolved in my life that it has not impacted me. I live in a beautiful apartment in Brooklyn, New York, that my actual friend, my ex-girlfriend, she moved to Seattle and didn't want to lose this apartment. I've been here for 5 years. She doesn't want to lose the apartment, but doesn't trust anybody else to live here.
Mm. That's quite fortunate.
It's quite fortunate. So I didn't have to deal with meeting a new landlord and a background check. I was able to, a friend of mine in prison is friends with the owner of a gym in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And he said, hey, Craig's getting out soon. Hook him up with a job. The owner of the gym came to visit my friend one time. He said, do I get to meet him? And a guard let me sit in on a visit, which is a, you know, big no-no. And I had his 5 to 7 minute interview in the prison visiting room. And he said to me, he's like, you're good to go. Email me when you are at the halfway house. And I did that. And true to his word, he hired me. So I got a job right off the bat, making $12 an hour, working the front desk of a gym. I couldn't be happier, though, because it got me out of the house, got over that hump of finding a job. He clearly knew my story because of where our interview was. So that wasn't an issue. And You know, I do want to say something. I did misspeak just a little bit. I did try going back into the corporate world a couple of times, and I went on interviews, and I proactively mentioned that I had served time because I didn't want that cloud sitting over me. And the interviewers, a few of them actually said, they're like, we don't have a problem with it, but we have to check with HR.
Which in turn would have a problem with it.
Which in turn always had a problem with it. So I shouldn't say that it's never impacted me. It did impact those few things. Why I didn't say that is that I'm so happy that I didn't get those jobs and that I didn't go back into corporate and that I do what I do now. I'm so happy that I didn't, in a sense, fall back into that trap of going to a cubicle and, you know, just being part of that grind.
Just being part of that machine. And also, I guess there's a psychological detachment as well, though, Craig, because it's being part of that machine again. And it was that machine that got you involved. I know you did it yourself, but it was that industry being around, you know. I'm not saying it's temptation, because it's not temptation, but I think it's mentally breaking away from the industry, from that environment, effectively, and doing something completely brand new. That must be something that is, I guess, significant in your transformation.
Absolutely significant. This was, and this is what I did with it. It was an opportunity to start over completely from scratch, to completely reinvent myself and to create whatever it is that I want to create. When I did go for those corporate jobs, I was still in very much a scarcity mindset and very much, I need a corporate job. I need the health benefits. I need the retirement package. You know, I need all these things to live a quote unquote normal life. And I'm glad that I didn't get it. And then realized that I can create whatever I want.
And the interesting thing is those transformations can be triggered by multiple things, because, you know, for me, and we've spoken about this before, my own transformation at this part of my life is very much based on the fallout of COVID, the pandemic, because it's impacted my business significantly enough in those earlier months for me to kind of reevaluate and say, well, you know, I need to not necessarily reinvent myself, but reinvent what I need to do and the direction of my business, which interestingly enough, Craig, has resulted in me reinventing lots about myself. I've had a multitude of opportunities to go back to that corporate world of being involved in long-term delivery projects, long-term IT delivery projects that I just don't feel it anymore. I just don't. That is just an arena that I'm trying to avoid, because the lifestyle, the money is fantastic, but there's the lifestyle impacts. And for me, I always used to say that I really enjoy what I do for a living. I really do. You know, I'm a technologist. I'm an architect. I get to spend legally millions of pounds of other companies' money on buying hardware and software for them. And for me, it was a real buzz from it. But what I realized, Craig, was the pandemic provided me with a different lens on what I actually enjoyed from that. And I'm a people person. I love conversing with people. I love getting to know people. I work well in putting together delivery teams. But what I realized from that was I actually enjoyed spending the money. I enjoyed the privilege that the money actually gave you. And part of it, I think there was this fallacy in my head as well, where I thought the money gave me freedoms, but it didn't.
I love that. I thought my money gave me freedom. And it was just, I was in a prison cell before I was in prison. I was enslaved by my paycheck. And by the things that I did not own my things, they owned me. And I can totally relate to what you were just saying. That really resonated with me.
You think those things are bringing you happiness, the things that you need to, you know, buy more watches, drink more expensive wine. you feel as though partly, I think psychologically, you think it's a status symbol as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know,
and then
absolutely.
And then getting away from that. And it's interesting when you map back, ignoring some of those red flags, that even if those red flags were completely obvious to you, there is this thing, I think, which is driven by our egos, that you couldn't bring yourself back to dialing back the lifestyle.
I've been doing, it's funny that you bring that up. I've been reading right now just a lot about the ego, and very much able to put a lens, a 2020 lens on Craig pre-arrest. And it was it's just pure ego. And to be able to unwind that was inconceivable. It was, you know, as I was saying earlier, it's just the identity was those things and the status symbol. And I lived in a wealthy town in Connecticut. And, you know, there were the restaurants that we would go to were frequented by some of the biggest hedge fund managers around. And, you know, I'd regularly be sitting, you know, across from, you know, some of the biggest in the business. And, you know, I made good money. These guys were bona fide billionaires and I was chasing billionaires. And that's that status symbol of that wine, of that nice watch, and just, you know, trying to catch people that I would honestly, I had no chance of catching.
I want to change direction. And I know you're writing a book, but I'm curious about what drove you to put pen to paper. Journaling your experiences aside, what were the reasons around why you chose to use that format to communicate your thoughts?
It started in prison. It started when I was in prison, and it was very difficult to find somebody to talk to about the things that were going on in my mind. And it was a very natural outlet for me to buy a pen and journal from the commissary, go to the library where it was normally very quiet, and just get the things out that I wasn't comfortable saying to my fellow inmates. And I certainly couldn't say them to, you know, anybody who worked at the prison, any of the COs or anything like that. There were some dark thoughts. And there were also, you know, just some general complaints that I had. And I was, you know, I was worried that I had a 2-year sentence. Some of my friends had 12-year sentences. And I felt bad complaining about those when they had it so much worse than I did.
What were those dark thoughts that you were scared of communicating?
When you mentioned suicide in prison, you get locked in solitary. And that I was already feeling so isolated, the idea of being locked in solitary was utterly frightening. So writing became my outlet. I mean, writing was one of the things that helped save me.
I guess putting those thoughts down and just being able to, as you say, it's an outlet. It's a form of communication that you can almost feels like you're just communicating that back to yourself.
What a wonderful way to say that, because it really was. It was just journaling. And, you know, I think it's Tim Ferriss calls journaling windshield wipers for the brain. And it was just really dumping everything out and just clearing it. And the journaling started evolving to the point where themes started arising, you know, shame, guilt, embarrassment. In the beginning, I didn't see them. But when I kept writing about, maybe the topic was slightly different, but the emotion was still the same. And so those start coming up. And that led me to, I'm experiencing, you know, I maybe was consumed by shame, but it wasn't something that I actively said, I'm consumed with shame. It was more, I feel horrible. I feel lost. I feel hopeless. And getting it on paper allowed me to see that it was shame. And then that allowed me to explore it a little bit deeper of, you know, where did the shame come from? How can I move through the shame? And it's, you know, the identifying those patterns and those beliefs that start coming up when you journal over a period of time. That's what was so powerful about it. That really, you know, it was clearing the decks so that I could start doing the other deep inner work.
this is quite random, but I have this affiliation with rain. I find it beautiful because it comes down. I like the way it kind of touches the skin. I like the noise it makes, the way it kind of, you know, hits the leaves and just drops down. And my kids know that if it rains, I love to go for a walk in the rain. But it's that, as you said, about clearing the decks. You know, rain comes down, it washes things away, it helps things grow. And I think there is something around that because it allows you to kind of clean that palette.
It does. And I think when we go through a significant trauma, and I'm also thinking that we don't necessarily even need to go through a significant trauma, but if we want to embark on something, if we want to reinvent, if we want to start over, we do have to clear those decks. We do have to, because, you know, I'm thinking of, in a sense, almost like a sponge. A sponge can only hold so much water. And if you've got other things, you know, that are taking up that space, you're not going to be able to bring that creativity in. You're not going to be able to find a way to start over. So you clear the decks and now you've got this clean slate. And that's where you can start. And I think that's, you know, what journaling. So it was actually, you know, three practices in prison that were critical for me were meditation, journaling, and a gratitude practice. You know, those are three things that I still do every day 6 years later. I don't miss a day on any of those. It's, you know, I think they're that important.
When you were in prison, starting that gratitude practice, what were the key things that you were grateful for when you were in prison?
Prison was really, it was really hard to find things to be grateful for, which is why I think it made my practice so powerful. And I'll share a story with you of how my gratitude practice began in prison. I used to get up early in prison. I would grab all my books to get to the library before anybody else got there. And the prison I went to was on top of what's called One Mile Drive. And so it was up on top of a mountain. And I will tell you, we had the most beautiful sunrises and sunsets I think I've ever seen in my life. Just the way the curve of the mountain, and when the sun is coming up in the east, it would actually reflect off the mountain and bounce the colors off to the opposite side of the mountain. I mean, it was extraordinary. So I walked out from one building going to where the library was to another building. And it's a chilly morning, but I stop and I'm just in awe of this sunrise. The sky is a blaze of orange, and it was in the fall. So the foliage was just beautiful. The oranges and the pinks and the yellows, and everything was just on fire. It looked like, and I took a moment and I was floored by it all. And then we got a little bit cold and I went to the library and I just felt this natural need to open up my journal and write, "I'm grateful that I got to see this morning's sunrise." That started my gratitude practice. And I realized that felt so good to write that. So I started, you know, thinking of other things that I was grateful for. And I remember one of them was we had instant coffee in prison. You know, there was not a fancy coffee machine in prison. You would buy powdered coffee and cream from commissary. And it was hard to get the mixture just right to make a good cup. And that morning, I actually had made a good mixture and my coffee tasted really good. So I said, "I'm grateful that I got my combination correct this morning. I'm grateful that I had a good workout yesterday. I'm grateful that my friends helped me with something." And it started growing. And there were days that I was very repetitive. You know, I'd be grateful for the same thing over and over again. There were days that I maybe would only be grateful for one thing, and it might be that I got my coffee right. It might be that it was a nice temperature, you know, very innocuous things. But what I did was to make sure that I did it every single day, even if it was only one thing, because I knew that it would lead to something really good. I didn't know at the time what it would lead to, but I knew that this was a good practice.
I love the example of the sunrise, because it's like you were grateful for the things that you did have and the things that you could see, as opposed to what you didn't have, the rights that were taken away, the freedoms that you didn't have. You know, you weren't you weren't stripped of everything. It's quite refreshing to kind of think about the fact that symbolically, when somebody's down, we have this vision in our head that someone's got their head down and looking towards the ground, you know. And if you walk around looking towards the ground, you miss everything. And I know this myself, by I enjoy walking. And we have a really nice lake near us. And I walk around that lake. I walk around that lake for 20 years. It's the same walk. And if I'm just looking at the floor to avoid stepping in something, because a lot of dog owners don't pick up the dog's mess, then I feel like I'm constantly just walking around, just making sure I don't step into anything. And there's those days, Craig, where I thought, you know what, screw it. I will just clean my shoes at the end of my walk. And I'm just going to look up. And it's amazing that I can do the same walk every day. And if I look up, I see things that I've never seen before. It's like every day is a different walk.
How beautiful is that? And I was going to ask you that, in that 20 years that you've been walking around that lake, I bet you, you see something new every single time. Mm. And I mean, that's just a testament to the beautiful world that we live in. You know, it's, you're out in nature. So things are growing, things are evolving. Trees are getting bigger, trees are falling down. You're going to have wildlife that is there that wasn't there the other day. The clouds in the sky are always going to be different. The sun's going to be, you know, a little bit different. And it's just the color of blue, the shades of blue that can, that can happen. If you go at a different time of day, you're going to have a different perspective. And I think that's so, it's just such a powerful thing to look up. And I love the analogy that you had, because really, when we are down, we look down. It's hard to hold our head up.
And if you look at the example of yourself being in prison, and symbolically, the view that people have is you've got four walls, but you had more than four walls, but you have boundaries, right? But you were still able to look for what you could within those boundaries and be grateful for those things.
And that is, I really do think that it was almost the best place possible to start a gratitude practice for understanding how amazing it is to be able to do that. But I would love to touch upon something that you said, that to be able to find the things and not focus on the things that had been, and I won't actually say taken away from me, I'll say lost, because I'm responsible for the choices that I made. So nothing was taken from me. Everything was lost. So the things that I lost, so what made my morning practice of meditation, journaling, and gratitude so interesting was the journaling was the things that I lost. The gratitude was the things that I had. They were running. They were two sides of the same coin that were happening. Now I say that I lost them. To be fair, when I was in prison, they were taken from me. I was still very much in the victim role. So that was coming out as, how dare they? I this was taken from me. You know, it was very much that. And then I would go into gratitude. So it was a strange dichotomy for me.
You made a point that these things weren't taken away from you. You lost them. How long did it take? And at what point did you accept responsibility?
I love this question. And I'm going to answer it, but I'm going to reframe just partially. Because when I realized I had to give meaning to the suffering that I had caused my wife and my family, when I started turning things around, there was actually one step before accepting responsibility, and that was accepting reality. And again, I'm in the prison library, and you know, I spent a lot of time there, but I was wishing that I hadn't made the choices that I made that landed me in prison. I was wishing that I was home with my wife, who at this point had already told me she was leaving me. But I was wishing that I was home with her and our cat and our dog on my couch. I wish I wasn't in prison. I wish I wasn't. So many wishes. And what happened was this light bulb went off. And I said, what I'm doing to myself is I'm trapping myself in the past that can't be changed. And I'm propelling myself into a future that I don't know. And it hit me, like I said, like a light bulb, where I just started writing. I accept that I made the choices that I made. I accept that I'm in federal prison. I accept that my finances are ruined. I accept that my wife is divorcing me. I went through close to a page of things that I had to accept. And when I was writing those things, they hurt like hell. You know, it was very, they stung. they stung a lot. But when I was done, all of a sudden a weight lifted off of my shoulders and I felt a bit of freedom inside prison, because what I had done was I had accepted my reality, but now and my reality may have sucked, but I had a baseline in which to start over. So that was actually the very first step that I took to rebuilding and reinventing my life. Then came, and this will lead to your question, that led to accepting responsibility. And that was a very similar type of situation, again in the library, again journaling, and realizing that I knocked the first domino down. It was my choice to hit the enter button to start the fraud and to continue and to perpetuate the fraud. And when I, same thing, wrote through on journal, I accept responsibility for this, I accept responsibility for that, I felt freedom again. And then that accepting responsibility, that transformed into realizing that I have to accept responsibility for the remainder of my life and what I'm going to do with it. And that was all of that. The accepting responsibility was first, or reality was first, then accepting responsibility. I was probably in about, I want to say, 10 to 12 months, I was already in prison by the time that those really kicked in.
Unlocking that mental prison, journaling your thoughts, brings me back to your book. And I want to cycle back around. And I'm curious about the title, A Blank Canvas. How did you shape the thought process around the title of the book?
Title is, it's one of my favorite stories. So when I was leaving prison to go to the Brooklyn halfway house, and we touched upon this a little bit earlier of the uncertainty of going to the halfway house and not having a place to live, I hadn't arranged the job at this point, just not knowing what I'm going to do, who's going to hire me, who's going to date a felon? Am I going to find somebody new to be with, to have a relationship? And my mentor, Ed, the same gentleman who greeted me that first day, he found out that I was going to the halfway house, and we were walking down the hallway of the education building. And he said, "You're going to the halfway house. Congratulations. What do you think?" And I said, "Ed, I have no money. I have no house. I have no job. Who's going to date a felon? So, you know, I'm excited to go, but I'm scared." And I didn't say this to Ed because Ed still had a bunch of years left on his sentence. But there was a part of me that, as much as I hated prison, it said it's a roof over my head and three square meals a day. You know, there's a certainty to it. I didn't say that to him. But Ed looked at me and he put his arm around me and he said, "Craig, you have a blank canvas. You can paint whatever picture you want." And I said, I was blown away by that. I was blown away by those words. And I had an opportunity to have lunch with the author Kamal Ravikant. And I told Kamal that story. And he looks at me from across the table and he goes, "Craig, that's the title of your book." And I looked at him and I said, I tilted my head like, you know, dogs when they're confused, they tilt their head. I looked at him with my tilted head and I go, "Is it?" And he goes, "Yeah, that's the title of your book." And he looks up in the air and he's thinking, he goes, "Blank canvas, how I reinvented my life after prison. That's your title of your book. That's your subtitle." He goes, "You're set." And that's how I got that.
That's brilliant. That really is. It's just, and you know, it really is a blank canvas. And the, you know, the reinvention of yourself, which is, I'm not going to say the reinvention started now, because from what we've discussed today, I want to just kind of tail him back, is that reinvention to me feels like it started in day two in prison, you know. And even though I'm really looking forward to reading the book when it's out. And is it landing at the beginning of next year? I think
it's going to be March 2021.
Exciting. And I believe you're self-publishing.
I am professionally self-publishing. So what that means is I've hired Scribe Media and they are handling the book's production from soup to nuts. They're doing the cover design, the interior design. They're helping me with the editing, with the marketing. You know, they've got a publishing package that they do. So they're taking care of all of that. I could have piecemealed it together myself, but I wanted to do it the correct way. And that was kind of fun because I couldn't afford Scribe's publishing package. And I decided to try a Kickstarter. And I had a successful Kickstarter campaign, which paid for the Scribe's publishing package. So we're in the midst of it right now. I'm working on the cover design with them as we speak. I have a call with them tomorrow.
That sounds very exciting.
It really is. It took me 5 years and 8 drafts to get this thing out of me. So to see it coming to life is so exciting, so nerve-wracking, and surreal.
I can imagine. And, you know, would you have thought before you'd, kind of just mapping back to the moment that you were arrested, you're at this point now where you are literally a few months away from the book being published. And would you have thought at that point you'd be at this stage now?
I thought my life was over. I thought my life was completely over. I couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. I had no idea what I could possibly do. The stories that I had made up in my mind about what it means to be a federally convicted felon and how much that was going to limit me and the fear of what was going to, I had no idea what my life was going to be like, but I had no expectation that it would be, quite frankly, as incredible as it is now. No idea that this was going to happen. Let's be honest, you and I would have a 1 in a billion chance of meeting had I not been arrested. And that's what's so rewarding about this experience now, is to be able to meet people such as yourself and to have these conversations that I would have never had I not done what I did.
Mm. And your circle of friends is increasing. It's a different set of friends. And I suspect there's a different authenticity in your life than there was before. A completely different authenticity. Well, no, let me reframe that. To me, it always feels like there is now an authenticity in your life.
Yeah, I was going to reframe it as well. I mean, you nailed it. There wasn't an authenticity before. Now there is. Now there is a genuine authenticity. And I still have some of my friends, you know, pre-prison, but my relationship with them has even evolved. But, you know, my close friends now were all a result of working at that gym. All of my closest friends, my dearest and closest friends who I admire, they're just the most amazing group of people. I would have never met them had I not gone through. And we do all have that level of authenticity, and we all are on very similar paths. And it's, you know, the kind of that, was it Jim Rohn that said, we're the average of the 5 people that we surround ourselves with the most, you know, and I couldn't be fortunate, and it's growing past 5, you know, it's expanding. Like I said, meeting you, meeting Kamal, meeting James, you know, it's incredible.
And it's meeting people that have a positive impact on your life. And Craig, I think this is a really good point at which we wrap up today's conversation. And I'd like to bring us back round full circle to the point where we started today's conversation. Parents love us as their children unconditionally. How do you now love yourself unconditionally?
What a huge and wonderful question. That took so long to get to that point. And it goes back to, it starts with that self-trust and the making and the keeping the commitments and knowing that I'm enough and that I'm worthy, and then forgiving myself. That opened up the door to be able to love myself fully, deeply, and unconditionally and implicitly. And it was such a tremendous journey to get to that point. I tried when I was in prison Kamal's book, Love Yourself Like Your Life Depends Upon It. I didn't read it when I was in prison. I read it when I was in the halfway house. But James Altucher mentions it in Choose Yourself. And so I tried what James had written about in Choose Yourself. I tried it when I was in prison, and I couldn't love myself. I just couldn't love myself because of all those other pieces that were missing. So I had to go through that evolution of that trust, of the enough, of the worth, to get to that place where I could love myself fully, deeply, and implicitly. Something else that was added into that was, how can I love myself when I'm so consumed by shame? When shame led me to plan how I was going to kill myself, which led me down the road of, how does one combat shame? And that is by being vulnerable. And that is by writing the book, by delivering the TED Talk, by sharing my story openly with people who want to hear it and who may need to hear it. And that was such a huge component of that, of the process of loving myself, because I had to unwind that shame. I had to dissolve it, because there was no way I could love myself if I had that shame. So it was a mission to own my story, because I knew if my story owned me, it would own me for the rest of my life. If I own my story, I own my life. And that was another piece of that puzzle to get to that loving myself. And it also, there's an acceptance that has to come in, an acceptance of myself as I am. And you touched upon it eloquently before, of the different paths that we take and, you know, that bring us to where we are today. Part of that owning the story is, it's accepting that I did make those choices. If I'm to deny any part of me, how can I ever be whole if I deny a part of me, even if it is something that at one point I didn't like to admit about myself? I'm still denying something, and I'm taking away that wholeness, and I'm taking away that ability to love myself and accept myself fully. So I hope that answers it. But that was my process, and it's a long one.
Craig, thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today, and just you giving me the opportunity to unpack your story is something that I wanted to do as soon as I first heard yourself on James's show. And it was just, there was intrigue. It was beyond just intrigue, though, because there were elements of your own story in a different way I could also relate to, as in just your journey in life itself, where there was, you know what, I can learn from that lesson. I can learn from this lesson. And that was it wasn't just the reason I wanted to connect with you, because I enjoy getting to know people better. And I've not just enjoyed this conversation, but I welcome you back at any point in the near future, because there's things that we just haven't had the time and chance to cover, which I want to look forward to unpacking at another time. But I'm hoping that, you know, we can use this as a kind of foundation to kind of build a relationship between us both. And you are welcome back, my friend, at any time in the near future.
Bobby, this has been such a joy. Because you're right, it's not an interview, it's a conversation. And it was a beautiful conversation. And I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity and for asking the questions that you asked and the insightfulness that you were able to bring into our conversation to create literally the foundation of what we were talking about. And really, I can't thank you enough for having me on, and I would love to come back. I genuinely appreciate you having me on and the conversation that we just had.
Wow, that conversation was an experience. There is just no way I could have done justice to Craig's story in less than the time that we conversed. We just kept going for hours, and it was gripping for me, and I hope it was immersive for you throughout this entire conversation. Now, as always, I will put a whole load of information about Craig and any of the topics that myself and Craig have discussed today, I'll punch those into the show notes of today's episode. Now, if you've enjoyed the episode, please remember to hit that subscribe button and rate and review this show on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. And feel free to recommend this show to your friends and colleagues. And spread the love on social media. It really helps me to promote the show. Now, my contact details and social media links, as always, will be in the show notes of today's episode. This is me, Bobby Jagdev, signing out of what was a feature-length episode of the Bobby Jagdev podcast. And a remarkable conversation to mark this 10th episode. So, once again, thank you for listening. Until next time.